Hey everyone, welcome to day three of Free Thought Fest 2. Thank you so much for coming again. Once again, it's a free conference and it's put on by AHA, and we're really excited that you came. I hope everyone had a great time the last 2 days, and we're going to finish it off with day number three. I'll just kick it off with our first speaker. She's an assistant professor at Miami University of Ohio. Please welcome Kathy Goodman.
Good morning, and thank you for being here at the first session. On the first day of daylight savings, you all deserve applause yourselves. Yeah. So when I was getting ready for this talk, I was thinking about the stellar lineup of speakers you've had over the past couple of days and how I feel so different than them. I don't have a blog. I don't have a podcast. Truthfully, I don't even listen to podcasts or read very many blogs regularly. And I'm not, I don't frequently give speeches or engage in debates. And I have never been invited to be on the Oprah Winfrey Show. But I guess what I come here with, and it's appropriate because today is kicking off the secular student section of the conference, and I do have some knowledge of doing research on college students and this field that most of you probably don't even know exists called student affairs in higher education. And so what I wanted to do was share some things with you about student affairs and about the current research about atheists, and use that information to come up with some ideas for how to make campuses more inclusive. And I have some ideas, but I'd also love to open it up to you at the end. My talk should go about 30 minutes, so there'll be plenty of time for you to share ideas with me as well that I can bring back. I am a member of the board of directors for the Secular Student Alliance, who's doing awesome work for all of us. So that's a great outlet to share ideas with. So most of you know what it means, probably, or have a good sense of what it means to be a professor. I teach classes, and I'm a total geek, and I love doing research, and I love reading research. And so there's about four or five studies I'm going to share with you a little later on, but I wanted to start with the second half of my title, which is that I'm an assistant professor of student affairs in higher education, and what that means. And student affairs, if you think about campus life, and you think about pretty much almost anyone outside of the classroom. So career services, residence life, Office of Diversity, Office of LGBT, academic advising, academic support. Most of those people fall under the realm of student affairs. And most of those people have a master's degree in student affairs to get that job. And so what I do is I teach in those master's programs, so help prepare those students. And so I want to share a little bit about kind of the concept of student affairs with you. And the first thing is that in student affairs, we're very interested in the whole student. So often when we think of college, we think of mind, knowledge, thinking, skills. But we're also concerned with those other parts of the students, their identity, values, beliefs, their interpersonal skills, because we face it, as a college student or any human being, you're always growing in those areas as well. So we try to look at those things as well as the academic side of things. But we also think about, in addition to the student, we think about the campus environment, because we don't think it's not what a student gains out of college is not 100% based on what they put into it. As student affairs people, we have to create a campus environment that's inclusive and welcoming for them and creates the right conditions for them to learn and grow in those areas. And so we do that through out-of-classroom experiences, peer groups, educationally purposeful activities. And so those tend to be in the realm of student affairs. Excuse me, I've had a cold for the past week, and so there'll be little sniffles, I'm sorry. But one of the primary theories behind student affairs is this idea of finding that perfect balance of challenge and support. So we want to challenge people to think of new ideas, but at the same time provide enough support so they don't feel overwhelmed and shut down. And that's especially important when it comes to student development theory. And this actually, this is pre-student development theory. This is Piaget 101. The idea that students need dissonance. People need dissonance to grow and change. And so the example I have here is, I might come into college thinking atheists are immoral. They eat babies. They're horrible people. But then I have a roommate who's an atheist, and he's a really good guy. And so one of two things can happen. I can assimilate that, meaning I'm still going to keep my beginning beliefs. Atheists are immoral, but I'm going to like have this little, but my roommate, he's the exception to the rule. What we'd rather have happen is we would rather have accommodations, so people change how they think, and so they come around and realize, oh, atheists do have morals, they just come from a different place than I might be thinking where morals come from. And this is true for any kind of learning. I used an example of someone who is not atheist. Could be the same way. I come to campus, I grew up Catholic, I went to church every weekend, and now all of a sudden I see this group, the SSA, and they say that there are people who don't believe in God. And I'm like, damn, I never knew that could happen, right? Mom and Dad didn't tell me that. And so that's this dissonance. And will I assimilate that and be like, oh yeah, they exist, whatever, but I'm Catholic? Or will I accommodate and say, hey, they make some good points, and maybe that's how I think as well? And so how this whole process happens, of course, is very tricky. It's different for everyone. There's no magic number of if you have the right amount of dissonance, all of a sudden you're going to change. In student affairs, we use this vague phrase a lot of time, meeting the students where they are, meaning, you know, not everyone's going to want the same thing. JT's talk last night was great about like really questioning Christians about their beliefs and helping them maybe see logical places. That's great if they've already started to engage in the conversation and understand that there are non-believers, but it's not going to work if it's that person I just described who's just come to campus, never even knew there could be such a thing as atheism before they got there. So from a student affairs perspective, then, we look again at two sides. We look at individual support. So that's creating that safe space where they can have that personal development and have conversations about who they are and how they came to be that way. But we also need to work on the campus change side of things. So educating others about what we're all about and tolerance building. And I know tolerance is a word that kind of has a bad name, but I'm using this definition. So it's a fair, objective, and permissive attitude toward those whose opinions, practices, race, religion, nationality, etc., differ from one's own. Freedom from bigotry. And I think that's a good thing for us to aim for. So that's the student affairs side. Now I want to tell you about a few different research studies. And this one, the first one, comes from Smith in 2011, who did a small study, a qualitative study of how people become an atheist. And he talked about how in the United States, it starts with this idea that there's this ubiquity of theism. Even if you don't grow up in a family where there is religion, theism is everywhere, right? Turn on Fox News or look at your money in your wallet or go to class and say the Pledge of Allegiance and theism is there. And so with that as the starting point, then the people in his study had to get to this point where they were questioning theism. And a lot of times it had to do with engaging with moral issues and science and feeling like the things that they read in the Bible or heard from religious people didn't seem moral to them. And so they looked to new places like science and humanism and began to reject theism. And that came with a rejection of the supernatural and this idea of constructing an identity of that's not me. So we all know what religious people are, that's not me. But then it moves into a more a positive approach in that they actually claimed atheism. So they it was validated through social interactions. They found it difficult due to stigmatism, but they also found it empowering. It gave them confidence. It liberated them. So obviously it's a small study. We can't generalize to huge populations, but we know there's one group of atheists that this person studied that had that experience. And you'll see the theme across several of these research articles that I'm going to share with you. The next one is a study that I recently completed, and it's under review right now. But it was actually looking at the relationship between atheism and feminism, and do they necessarily go hand in hand or not. And we talked to 10 atheist men, and we asked them to talk about not just how they think about gender and feminism, but to talk about atheism and how they came to be that way and how it relates to their feminism. Excuse me. So what we found with these 10 men is that they had a proclivity for free thought. And by that, it was that they were committed to questioning things and prioritizing reason over everything else. And they believed that most gender differences were due to the culture and social construction in our society, and that gender inequality is a problem within the U.S. and throughout the world. What we found was that there was this interaction about, they had this intellectual orientation that helped them reject religion and supernatural beliefs, helped them become atheism, and it led to them believing in gender equality, and this was kind of this reinforcing cycle. So once they rejected supernaturalism, they embraced this intellectual orientation or free thought. They believed almost across the board that religion encourages unequal gender roles. And when they looked at values based on humanism, science, and reason, they weren't down with that. And so they believed in gender equality. But you'll see, even though this is about feminism and atheism, that they went through some of those same stages that I talked about in the prior study of rejecting religion and embracing this intellectual orientation. So the next study was about how individuals become atheists by Fitzgerald in 2003. And again, it's the same kind of themes. That among her participants, it began with doubts, questions about the religion they were raised in. Most of the people in her study were raised in some kind of religious family. And they began to question organized religion and just religion in general. And then that led to the doubt about the question or existence of God. Now, this was a very slow, gradual progression. These were older people in her study, people that obviously identified as atheists. And what she found was that for people who grew up in families that were highly religious, this process took longer than for other people, like years, a course of years. She also looked at why individuals become atheists. And I think we often hear the myth of something bad must have happened to you. Did someone die and you lost your belief in God? And in fact, what she found is there's a lot of factors that contribute to why individuals become atheists, but there's no one or two even top reasons among her participants. So on the individual side, again, you're going to see these themes of there's this commitment to intellectual and critical thinking, this love of science and religion, science and research, sorry, disagreements with religious teachings, a feeling that there's hypocrisy among religious people, and then that problem of evil. And so those individual factors would then be reinforced by social factors. Socialization meant that some people grew up directly in families that embraced the idea of atheism or free thought, whereas others grew up in families that embraced religion, but they still were indirectly socialized, maybe because those families didn't go to church a lot or didn't make a big deal out of it. A secondary socialization were all those kind of factors in the world that also might contribute to them thinking about and becoming atheists. Higher education, coming into contact with other atheists. She called it the unintentional effects of secondary agents of religious socialization, meaning coming into contact with religious people that made these people think, I don't want to be like that. And so that these kind of social experiences then influence the individual factors, and it's kind of just this round and round thing with no one specific. The next study is my good friend and colleague John Mueller did again qualitative study, small study of atheist college students, and found these themes. He found in the category of moving from faith to reason, that they found a lack of fulfillment from religion, that they just weren't relating to religion anymore, and this desire to learn more science and reason again. And in the category of meaning and purpose in life, that they found hypocrisy among religious people who would preach one thing and then behave differently. They had a commitment to living now because death is the biological end of life. So they built their values based on humanity, science, and philosophy. I'm assuming these things all sound familiar to most of the people in this room. And they were also living in the margins, trying to decide, do I just blend in by not saying anything, or do I actually disclose that I'm an atheist? And related to that was whether they, the decision whether to organize or not. And some of these students felt very strongly that to organize would make them too much like a religious group, and so they were against it. But others could see the value of coming together, learning from each other, making their belief system more visible. So that brings me to this very interesting study that Lou did. And again, small study, 11 people. And it was how to manage an atheist identity. And the people in his study all recognize that atheist identity is highly stigmatized in the U.S., that people want consistency between how they see themselves and how they think others perceive them. So you want to be an out and open atheist, but you don't want grandma to think that you're going to go to hell, essentially. So there are three strategies that they found. Affirming, meaning they came out and said they were atheists, and that increased their self-esteem. It helped them define their own meanings for atheism, helped them find social support from other atheists once they were out about it. But others used passing, again, to avoid that stigma and conflict, maintain relationships. This was actually often found among his participants. I made the joke about grandma, but they really did use this more with grandparents because they didn't want to upset their grandparents, so they didn't disclose to them. And then the most of them used deceptive disclosure, meaning retaining. They wanted to try to find that balance of their self-esteem, but also avoid conflict associated with revealing the identity, and they wanted to respect other people's beliefs. Oops. So that's the end of the studies. So what am I going to take away from this? So as I said, with the student affairs, we have two focuses, one on individual students and one on the environment. So for individual students, I think it's important for students to have in-group only opportunities. So groups on campus where students can just go, be open, be themselves, say whatever they want and feel safe, know that they're not going to be stigmatized or degraded in that setting. The SSA recently reached having 400 campus groups. So that's great. That means there's 400 places for students to have those kind of activities. I think there's like something like 2,500 colleges in the United States. So there's more room to grow and make those spaces for people as well. But once those spaces and groups exist, it's an opportunity to talk about how they came to their beliefs, how their beliefs are similar and different to each other and to believers. So it's managing that whole identity and understanding oneself better, and talk about personal values and morals and what informs them. And all of this, by working in group, can help them with their communication skills, especially talking out of group then. Last night, Dan Barker said something about when he went on the Oprah Winfrey show, he had never even talked about atheism before. What a brave guy. But so it's the same for many of these students, right? They've never talked about these things before. They need a place where they can learn how to do that. And I think that lastly, the organization is a good place to encourage those who haven't to come out and to help them realize that they will reach that sense of empowerment and feeling more confident in their identity if they do that. And also teaching tolerance of other beliefs during this process, that it's okay to be tolerant that these other perspectives exist, and that doesn't mean I'm still not fully committed to my own identity. And that's a difficult challenge for students to realize, you know, just because you exist and you have a different identity, that's not a threat to me. I can accept that you're that, and I can still be who I am. So on the environment side, the thing that having organizations does is it provides visibility, and that can be important on campuses where a lot of people, I work at Miami University in Ohio, 17,000 undergrads, primarily well-off, primarily white, primarily Christian. And a lot of these students don't come necessarily thinking evil thoughts about atheists. They come just not understanding, not even knowing that atheists exist or not knowing how atheists think. And so just by being visible on campus, you're creating that dissonance for those students to start to think about another perspective. A second thing about the campus environment is I think that especially those of us who work in student affairs, to push back on an administration when there's problems. For example, on our campus, atheism, and I'll explain more about this later, but atheism gets tied up in interfaith efforts a lot, but our president says we're a public university, so we can't do anything interfaith, which is just a gross misrepresentation of what the Constitution says. So we push back on him and we say, yeah, we can talk about these issues on campus. We can have debates. We can have panel discussions, and that's okay. And it's an educational opportunity for people. Another example I can think of, I mentioned my friend John Mueller, and he works at Indiana University of Pennsylvania. And when he was trying to help the secular student group get set up on his campus, he got caught up in this thing where one part of the administration said that they had to be classified as a religious group, and another part said, no, you're not a religious group, and so they could never get whatever system was in place to actually get set up. And he had to intervene and help these students push back on the administration. And so I think that that can be, that's a common thing on campus environments. Another thing is to integrate atheist perspectives in classes or student activities. Again, many of these students have never even heard of these perspectives. They don't really get, you know, that whole thing about how can you be good without God. And to us, it seems so easy, but just being able to talk about that to people who've never really thought about it is a great way to introduce them to new perspectives and to then normalize atheism and make it a more inclusive campus for everyone. I am saying on here encouraging interfaith activities and inclusion of atheists in that. Some people might disagree and not want to be associated with interfaith activities, but I think from a kind of, I don't know if it's realist or cynical perspective, interfaith dialogues are growing on campus. It's becoming very important among student affairs staff, and if it's it's a place where we can be part of the conversation rather just being left on the sidelines. So I do think it's important to be involved in those kind of things. And I think there are things that we can adapt from the LGBT community and racial diversity organizations and offices on campus. The idea of safe zone and training, I know that the Secular Student Alliance rolled out a safe zone program for high schools last year. I'd like to see at some point in the future that we do something like that at the college level. For those of you who don't know, Safe Zone is it's an LGBT training, and it's people on campus go to this training so that they know about LGBT students, and then they have this little sticker, so they have this visible thing that they put up, and that way people know that's a safe person. I can talk to that person about being LGBT, and that's okay. So I'd like to see something like that with the, you know, I guess the big A. On campuses, especially lately in this age of accountability, there's a lot of focus on assessment. And so the diversity organizations and LGBT have done a good job at assessing the campus climate for their particular groups and sharing those results across campus. And that's a good way to garner attention and help move the campus toward a more inclusive step. And I think, and my research partner John Mueller thinks especially, this is a really important area for us to start making interventions and start doing these kind of assessments for atheist students as well. And then last, there's also some efforts on having diversity dialogues, and those typically focus on racial diversity, and there's kind of like rules and guidelines and articles about how to do that, and we need to develop that for having diversity dialogues about faith and non-faith as well, non-belief. So those were my ideas. In a few minutes, I'm going to ask you to react to them and also share your ideas. But there's this one last thing that I'm kind of tacking in the end because I didn't know where to talk about it. One of the things in student affairs and higher education, in the past like decade and a half, there's been this big push for spirituality. And I think there are some atheists who can relate to that word, and there are some atheists who want nothing to do with it because it's too associated with religion. And I think that the people on campus who are promoting spirituality, they really are interested in the whole student. Those ideas I talked about at the beginning, helping students find their identity, their beliefs, what gives meaning to their life. And they mean spirituality in a very open way. One thing about people in student affairs is they do want to be inclusive. They are well-intentioned, even though they might not have all the information they need to be that way. And so a couple of years ago, mid-2000s, there was this big study of spirituality among college students, and it was done by the Higher Education Research Institute, which is one of the primary research organizations in higher education. It's at UCLA, and they surveyed 15,000 students, and they've written books and books and articles talking about spirituality in higher education and how students today are more spiritual than ever. And what I'm trying to do is disrupt that way of thinking a little bit and get people to step back and realize if spirituality is not a word that everyone can relate to or not a concept everyone can relate to, then it's not really the inclusive idea that we think it is. And I went to a day-long conference on spirituality in higher education, and after about a day of talks, a young man raised his hand during the Q&A and said, "I'm an atheist, this stuff doesn't work for me." And the speaker said, and this was like, it was heartbreaking but telling at the same time, because this is someone who's very well respected in the field of higher education and student affairs, very well intentioned, and he said, "Oh, but you're included. We want it to be inclusive." And somehow he was missing that basic thing that you should know in student affairs, that doesn't matter how I define things, it matters how you define things when it comes to yourself and your identity. So I'm trying to kind of disrupt the thinking around that, as I said, and get people to realize that really the more inclusive idea is how people find meaning in their lives, how they develop their purpose. And there are different pathways to doing that. For some people, it is spiritual. For some people, it's religious. For other people, it's secular. And if we come at it from these three different perspectives that can overlap or not for different people, then we're creating a more inclusive dialogue for people to be part of. And so I recently was able to get the data that the Higher Ed Research Institute did for their atheist college, or for their study of spirituality. And I am now going to do an analysis of it, just looking at the students who said they don't believe in God. And I'm going to try to look at these spirituality concepts that the investigators of the study created and named, and I'm going to try to show, are they relevant for atheist students or not? And I suspect they're not, but we're going to do that analysis. And then I'm going to use that data to look at what are some background characteristics, what's the worldview, what are the academic experiences of college students who don't believe in God, and then what college experience contribute to change in spirituality for atheist students. And really, I don't mean spirituality, I mean their sense of self, their sense of life purpose, their values. So what are the experiences on college that can help atheist students develop in those areas? So this is a reanalysis of data that already exists, and they've never looked at it from this aspect before. And then after I do that, then the next step will be to develop my own, what I want to be a national survey of atheist college students. And it will build on this work and were ideas that I get from engaging in conversations at campuses like this. So now I want to open it up to you. And there are four kind of things that I want to do. You can, of course, ask me questions about anything I've talked about. I'd also love to hear ideas and suggestions you have about supporting atheist students or creating inclusive campus environments. And you can react to things I've said or suggest new ideas. And then I'm also interested if you have some ideas, especially the atheist students that are in the room, what's the type of research you'd like to see or participate in regarding atheist college students? What do you want people like me, people like the administration on campus, what do you want them to know about yourselves? And if you're not a student, but you're someone who works on a campus, what's the kind of information you'd like to see me gather that would maybe be useful in your work in creating a more campus environment? So with that, I'm going to open it up to you. We have a person that's going to help with the mic, and it looks like we have about 11 minutes. And I'm going to grab a piece of paper so I can write ideas.
I want to ask a question regarding the last part of your presentation, spirituality, because you've worked in the field, in the social situations on campus. As you point out, it's kind of a double-edged sword. If atheists say, no, we are not spiritual, then we are classified as people who do not appreciate nature, do not understand art, do not care for literature or whatever. But if we do say, well, no, atheists are spiritual, then that puts us in a situation where, well, see, atheists actually believe in God, too, so we can do all these religious things. In your experience, do you think it makes more sense if you have to go one way or the other to say, well, okay, yes, atheists are spiritual also, or does it make more sense to try and fight against the current and say, no, you're not going to use this deepity where it means one thing and both, and then bring in religion by calling atheists spiritual? Because normally when that comes out, people say, aha, deep down they all believe in a higher power. What is your...
I agree. That was a great summary of the situation. And I think that it's going to differ in different places. But my take has been, I'm going to engage in that conversation if it's the only place I can have the conversation about atheism, because it's a starting place. I would never expect an atheist student to say they're spiritual if they're not. Like, they need to be able to identify for themselves who they are and what they believe and how they classify that. But I can give you an example. As I said, I teach student affairs, people that are going to be working in the student affairs field. And on college campuses, there's so many rules and regulations, as some of you may know, and I wanted to teach a new course, and I wanted to talk about some of these things, and I had to use a course that was already on the books. Otherwise, it's a two-year process to develop a new course and get it approved by the regents and blah, blah, blah. And so there's a course on the books called Spirituality and Leadership. And so I'm teaching that course, but I'm coming to it from a very different perspective. And the reality is, I think it's a good opening into that conversation for this particular group of students. I have about 20 students, well-meaning. Most people in student affairs really do want to be open and inclusive. They just might not have been exposed to certain ideas. And I'm finding that with this group of students. So they come in and they think I'm going to talk about warm, fuzzy spirituality. And then I hit them with, hey, this concept might not be as warm and fuzzy as you think. And I can already see, and most of them identify, I think 100% of them identify as some form of religious or other. And but I can see them already changing their language and changing how they think about it and making it a more open conversation. So instead of just saying spirituality, they'll say spirituality, religion, and secularity. And so these are 20 new people that are going to go out and work on campuses in the country, and they're going to have a new way of speaking. So I don't think it's ideal. I worry about getting mushed into that conversation, but I also worry about getting completely excluded. So it's a balancing act.
Kind of along those same lines, but when you're talking about spirituality or spiritual quest concepts, I think some of that might depend on how that person came to atheism. You know, you can come to it through rational means, through properly applied skepticism, or you can also come to it through other means or irrational basis of thinking, which can still leave you open or susceptible to other kind of woo concepts like ancient aliens, conspiracy theories, etc. Have you thought about it, or do you incorporate questions about skepticism into your research on atheism?
I definitely want to do that in my own research. In the research, the data that I'm reanalyzing, I'm limited to what they've already collected. But again, I think it's worth reanalyzing that data from a different perspective because it's an entry into the conversation. And one of the things about survey research that people might not know is when you're talking about something, if you're asking a question about how many classes did you skip last semester or what's your age, those are very discrete questions where people know the answers. If you're trying to figure out things about skepticism and spiritual quest, those are very fuzzy concepts. And so what they do is they create a series of questions that are trying to get at that concept. And my guess is, and as I said, I haven't done the analysis, my guess is that the way the questions that these survey administrators put together to represent these concepts aren't going to work the same way for atheist students as they would for non-atheists. And that's why I want to look at that, pull it apart, find which questions are they answering higher on, lower on, and look at some of their background experiences too. I won't be able to have, at this point, as much a background about how they came to atheism, but that's something I will incorporate as I move forward in my own research. After that, there's someone over there too.
So my question is, how do you define the philosophical concept of like human nature?
I don't know. I'm not a philosopher. I don't know that I've thought about it that much. Is there something specific?
Psychology side?
A lot. I come at it from both psychology and sociology, and that's how a lot of student affairs draws on both of those fields, because obviously, you know, there are some things that we are born with and think about, but there's much that we're socialized into, as my research on atheism and feminism showed, that those atheist men were very aware that gender is socially and culturally constructed. So I bring both aspects to it.
So earlier in your talk, you were talking about how an important step for in developing an atheist identity was learning tolerance of other beliefs. And yet for many atheists, we don't tolerate other beliefs. We don't tolerate other people's beliefs because we think they're mistaken and we think they do harm. And do you think that there is value in reframing that from tolerating other beliefs to tolerating other believers. You know, can we, you know, disagree and even disagree vehemently with religious belief while still, you know, accepting basic principles of diversity and tolerance of other peoples and their right to hold beliefs?
Yes, that's perfect. Thank you for saying that. I will adjust my speaking accordingly, because that is what I'm trying to say. Obviously, you know, as atheists, we don't believe in any religious perspectives, and so it's hard to tolerate them. But at the same time, part of, especially in on campus life, you're learning to live with people that are different from you, and so it's being tolerant of those people. Thank you.
For students who are on a campus where the administration is constantly stonewalling an atheist student group from stuff like, you know, getting funds or holding events or generally making waves, do you have any advice for us as to how we can get along better with the administration?
Well, I would say one of the things is to find your allies on campus. And sometimes that's not obvious. I was kind of amused, actually, a couple of days ago. I saw on the Secular Student Alliance of Miami University, they posted on their Facebook page, hey, did you ever hear of this professor, Kathy Goodman? Because she's speaking at the Freethought conference. And so I am an ally, but I have not made myself known to them. So sometimes it's like finding those connections, asking around who might be an ally for you. And of course, there's certainly the Secular Student Alliance can provide you some resources and guides, but otherwise it's just like, keep up the fight.
You may mention that in the university where you work, there isn't a whole lot of diversity of both race and economic background. And just like looking around this room and at Freethought Fest last year, I don't see a whole lot of ethnic diversity in this environment. Have you done any research, or have you seen any research about the diversity of non-believers or reaching out towards ethnic diversity within the non-believing community?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's interesting because I always run into, I want to say people of color, but it's often African Americans who say, hey, I don't believe, but that's really a scary thing to say in my community, and so I don't know where to begin. And I think if you look at, it's interesting, I have survey data from the 1930s in our country up until now, and if you look at the demographics, right, atheists have always been white, predominantly male, and predominantly well off. And part of what I'm wondering is, with this big shift to the nuns, if we actually get more up-to-date data about college students, that we might see more diversity there. And once we can start showing that that diversity exists, I think that makes it easier for other students, students of color, to join in and feel like they could be part of it. And I think that there's certainly an effort among organizations to also try to invite people of color, women, to these kind of conferences and events, and show that there is some diversity.
Thanks for that great talk.
Thank you.
I wonder if you know of any examples of university administrations which have listened to what you're saying and like implemented any kind of programs to support atheists. Just from my own experience, it seems like there's a lot of support for things like multiculturalism, LGBT rights, like women's centers, things like that, but it seems like universities are so reluctant to get into the business of religion at all, so atheism kind of falls within that, and they just don't want to touch it.
I think you're right. I think we're at the beginning of our battle in that way to get included. There's what, like four campuses now that have, humanist chaplains, right? So that's a sense that there are places out there that do recognize that this is a valid perspective and it needs to be more broadly addressed on campus. But no, I think it's like a one-on-one, whatever's happening on individual campuses, and I haven't heard any amazing good stories lately. But Jesse Galef is talking next, and he might have some good ones. There's a gentleman back there, and then the gentleman back there with the hat, and then maybe after that we have to end, right?
I think in Europe they got their strategy for this interfaith problem of a new word, life stance. So I've got the word referred to religious and non-religious. And I wonder if you think that we could do something like that, if we could get consensus on a strategy in our organization, in our overall coalition, either two words, faith and something, or a new word, or is that just futile?
I'm a little bit of a cynic, so I'm feeling futile at the moment, but it might be possible. I know, like, I've been working in this area since 2005, and I've tried to introduce terms like, instead of spirituality, to think about inner development or worldview, or, you know, life stance is another good word. I think we can possibly get there, but I don't think it's going to happen in the next couple years. I think it's a slow road. Yes.
All right, final question.
Hi, I'm a high school theater teacher, and one of the things that I see quite frequently is need to self-identify, but a frustration in the high school world of not being able to find somebody to identify with. I would suspect that as an atheist college student, it would be easier to self-identify, and so therefore, once you're able to get into that environment, then your research data actually becomes possible. But have you done any work, or is there any extant thought about surveying atheist high school students and how that transition happens once you graduate high school, once you leave the nest, as it were, and then are able to self-identify? And if there isn't, would you please do that?
I am writing it down right now. I'm not aware of any research like that. I was going to say the Secular Student Alliance does have high school groups that are just beginning to bubble up, but they've bubbled up a lot in the past year. And within their high school programs, they do have the this idea of a safe zone program, so that there is some kind of visible way to identify who your allies might be. But I love the idea of extending the research to look at both high school students and then that whole transition period. So thank you.
All right, we're out of time. Let's give another hand for Ken.
Thank you very much. Email me. My email address is there. So if you have more questions or ideas, I'd love to hear from you.